Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
What up, what up, what up? Happy New Year, everybody. Yes, it's the Man of Steel. That's right, Michael Steel. I'm back in the house in 2019. And boy, has the year started off with some fireworks and some fun. Now, before we get into the fun and the meat of the show, I got to settle up on a little business. You know you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you can get your podcasts on. That's where you're going to find me. And certainly you can find me on Twitter at Michael Steel. Well, we've got The Wall. We've got Shutdown. We've got Mueller. We've got Manafort. And a whole hell of a lot more. Progressive taxation, for God's sake. Where did that come from? It's there. It's on the table now. And we got history, because history is oftentimes a prelude, a prologue to the experience you are having currently. And I can't think of anyone better to help us give some context to these big issues that we're rolling around with today than a good buddy of mine, colleague over at MSNBC, the one and only Steve Kornacki. He is the national political correspondent for NBC News and MSNBC. Folks, he's got this kick-ass book out. You got to pick it up. If you have any inkling of politics running through your veins or interest in political history, if you want to understand the space we're in right now, he sets out in his new book the history of how we got here. It's The Red and the Blue, the 1990s and the Birth of Political Tribalism. It's the one and only Steve Kornacki. Welcome to the Man of Steel, man.
Wow, I hope I can live up to that introduction. That was really generous of you. Thank you.
No, man, I'm a huge fan of yours, have been for a long time. And this book, I've got marked pages, I've got tabs. I'm serious, man. This book, folks, is a history lesson. If you really want to get your fingers into the meat of the environment we're living in today and how it all began. So I thought it'd be a lot of fun, Steve, just to sort of set it up for folks. So when we get into some of these other topics like the wall and the shutdown and the kind of back and forth tensions that we see being played out between Trump and the Republicans and Trump and the Democrats and Trump and the leadership, give us a little taste of the book and what you did looking at the late 80s and specifically the 1990s, the emergence of Newt Gingrich, who can actually be considered the father of today's current tribalism in some respects. Walk us through what you discovered and how you kind of put all this together.
Yeah, no, Newt looms very large in that story, and what you're saying there, you know, absolutely, you know, rings true to me. Just, I was researching this book, obviously during the 2016 campaign, a little bit after, you know, last couple of years, and it one of the most fun parts of doing the research. I'm the kind of person that, you know, I can't spend enough time around newspaper archives and old television news archives, but one of the best things for me was just you could see so much of the present in the past. You could see the seeds of the present. You could see direct parallels between the past and the present, and just constantly being able to kind of measure what was going on in the world as the Trump era kind of took hold, against where things were a generation or so ago. It was a very interesting experience for me, and I really hope that comes through in the book. And yeah, you mentioned, you know, Newt. I think Newt is one of several major political players of that era who I think, you look at them and you can draw a straight line to Trump, you know, a couple decades later. You know, the thing with Newt was just institutionally, I think he ends up being the force that changes Congress.
Right.
That changes Congress into kind of what we know it is today. I mean, we're talking about a shutdown right now. The most famous government shutdown, maybe before this one, was 1995. It was
right.
It was Newt Gingrich, the first Republican Speaker of the House in 40 years, and Gingrich, and this is a big part of the book, is that sort of long climb of Newt Gingrich from, he comes to the House just this kind of gadfly. He's in the, they called the Republican Party a permanent minority back then. He tells Republicans he's going to lead them to the majority someday. And his style is just, it's combat politics. It's, voters need to see every day, everything that happens on the floor of this House, every speech that's given, every bill that's considered, every committee hearing that's held. They need to see a contrast between the Democrats and the Republicans. If you compromise, you're muddling the differences. You're not showing them a contrast. Gingrich had this vision of, in the Republican Party, make people see what he called a conservative opportunity society against the Democratic Party and the what he said, the liberal welfare
yeah.
state. He wanted that contrast to come through, and that was the style that got him to the top. And then when he became Speaker, ending 40 years of Democratic rule, he applied that same style, and that was the whole idea of that big government shutdown in 1995. He was going to create this contrast between the Republican Congress and Bill Clinton. It was going to be over deficits. It was going to be over the size and scope of government, those two competing sort of visions. And he believed that was going to sort of be the death blow of kind of Bill Clinton and more broadly, modern liberalism, the Democratic Party. And obviously, that's an area where he miscalculated. I mean, he made so many correct political calculations on his way up, but the equation changed when he became Speaker, when he had that kind of profile, that kind of platform. And that shutdown in 95 ended up being sort of the origin story of Bill Clinton's political resurrection
right.
in 1996.
So we paid the price in 1996. I want to go back because I really want to give people a flavor of how you captured what you just described in the book. You talk about that permanent Democratic Congress that had been in place since the 1950s. A lot of Republicans had kind of gotten into that sort of go along to get along. It's like, okay, we've been beaten. And that's why I tell people, I laugh when I hear people talking about gerrymandering, and particularly Democrats today, because I say, wait a minute, you guys were fine when you gerrymandered the House for 40 years. You were perfectly okay with 40-year rule of the House.
Yeah.
And so as soon as Republicans grab it, it's like, oh, my God, no, gerrymandering is the most god-awful thing on the planet. But that was the state of political affairs back in the day. You note in the book, a liberal consensus had dominated Washington since the Depression when FDR combated economic crisis with a massive expansion of the federal safety net, right? And so all of this stuff kind of fed into this stew that a guy like Gingrich looked at and said, this is pissing me off. I've had enough of this.
Mm-hmm.
How can I rework this system? So what he decided to do, to your point, was to make an example. And the individual he wanted to make an example of was Charlie Diggs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Charlie Diggs, folks, if you don't remember, had just been convicted at that time of a federal corruption charges. And if you go back, it involved stamps and the payroll in his office and all kinds of crazy stuff. Well, here's the rub. Tip O'Neill, who was the Speaker of the House, said, it was up to Diggs whether or not he wanted to leave the House, because the gentlemanly thing to do was not to expel the member, just leave it up to him. If he felt his actions were egregious enough, he'd leave. That was the triggering point. Newt went out, made a big deal about this, really started that combative, in-your-face, raw kind of ungentlemanly politics, to the point that the Republican leader, John Rhodes, who was a good friend of mine, I got to work with him after he left Congress, he offered a motion to expel, and damn it, would you know it, the vote passed 322-77. So you see that Newt had tapped into something. The problem was he couldn't control it, and it ultimately got the best of him, and now as we see the Republican Party. Is my analysis kind of close on that?
Yeah, and I think the thing he tapped into, and again, I think this is another, sort of parallel to Trump, it's populism. And I think that's, I was trying to figure out through writing this, you know, what is the, you know, what is it that kind of drove Newt Gingrich? You know, was it an ideology or is it an ideology? What is it? And I think the thing, when you look at him, the thing that ties every iteration of his career together is he is fascinated with the power, the potential power of populism. And I think it started, he had this sense coming out of, really out of the 1960s,
right,
the late 60s, you know, time of all, you know, social upheaval in this country, sexual revolution, all this sort of thing. I think he really bought into that idea, the Nixon idea of a silent majority. You know, that there was a silent majority of Americans out there who didn't share the values of what was becoming the dominant culture. And his challenge was to harness that politically. And he thought that there was, that majority would be what lifted Republicans from permanent, you know, minority status. And he wanted the Democratic Party to be seen as sort of embodying this culture that he believed was alien to, you know, to the wide majority of Americans. And I think that the episode you're talking about kind of gets to that, because right, there's this clash there. It's this clash between sort of institutionalism and populism, right? Where, the Tip O'Neill Code, and it's just the code of Congress,
right,
for all those years. It was the gentleman's code. You don't question another member's honor.
Right.
If Charlie Diggs got convicted of federal corruption charges but is awaiting appeal and wants to vote on tax bills, right, not our place to question. And
right,
of course, they're also all question. They're also kind of, I think, all saying to themselves, hey, it could be me in his shoes,
right,
sometime.
Because, look, they had some stamps running through their office as well. So.
Yeah, and it was a much looser, and that was the thing. There was an element of scrutiny that was just missing from the whole thing, because, you know, Newt gets in there. He's sworn in, and the episode you're describing is early 79. That's when Newt first came to Congress.
Right.
And that was also when C-SPAN for the first time put cameras in there. These proceedings until that moment in history had been, you know, if a reporter was there watching, they could write it down. But otherwise, nobody's watching this on TV.
Right.
And just Newt had that sense that, like, this is the kind of thing that makes perfect sense institutionally to every member in this room, but is going to seem totally different to average Americans if they hear about it. They're going to be offended at the idea, you know, of this guy still being there,
right,
voting, being welcomed by his colleagues.
Well, it was reality TV before there was reality TV.
And cable news. That's the other one, I think.
Yep,
it was.
Yep, cable news. So talk to me about tactics versus goals. So you have this, and again, folks, this is sort of helping us appreciate a little bit later on, like today, how this mess plays out the way it does. So you had Newt, who had come in, 79, turning over tables, knocking down lamps, you know, setting curtains on fire. Very aggressive strategy that the rank and file members were kind of liking, but they were hesitant, a little bit concerned of what the blowback could be about this uber partisanship that he was bringing to the table. So the leadership was starting to push back a little bit. And this was really one of the first times, again, to a point you made earlier, for Newt later on would come back to bite him, just as we see 20 years later it biting John Boehner, where the members started looking at the speaker, who was at that time a Democrat, as a tyrant, you know, and that going in and compromising with the opposition was the art of surrender. So, you know, there was this great quote in the book that I circled and underlined, and it's got me to this idea of tactics versus goals, where you had, it was quoted, Representative Michael and other Republican leaders share their aims but are troubled by their tactics, and the leaders
right,
feel that something precious is in danger. So all of a sudden, the leaders began to see that these tactics, these aggressive tactics, were beginning to erode, eat away at the underlying goals, the important goals of being a member of the processes of the House, et cetera, et cetera. Fascinating transition that even at that time, that even former Speaker Wright would comment on when he got the boot by Newt Gingrich a few years later.
And you know what it was? It was what Michael was kind of talking about there. I mean, it's what we would call, you know, bipartisanship, reaching across the aisle, that kind of thing. Bob Michael was his nickname literally was Mr. Nice Guy. He was the Republican leader in the House in the through the 80s, through the Reagan years and the first Bush years. And he was, one of his best friends was Tip O'Neill, the Democratic Speaker. They were golfing buddies. They had a real affection for each other. And, you know, the ranking Republican members on the committees generally would get along with the Democratic chairman, who were these old bulls who'd been there for, you know, like 40 years. And so there was a sense among that kind of class of Republicans. You know, Michael would tell Republicans kind of, he would say, you know, I've been here since the 1950s, and I have never served 1 hour of one day in the majority party. He knew nothing but minority party status. And this is a guy who at that point is pushing, you know, 65, 70 years old.
Yeah.
And so Newt looked at that, and the younger members looked at that, and they said, these guys like Michael are way too comfortable, you know, taking scraps from the Democrats. You know, they don't know what it is to stand up to the Democrats. They think it's so important to get along with the Democrats, but what's that ever going to get us? We're in jail here. And I really think the more I did the research and the more I think about it now, it's such a huge moment of change there in the House. Is when Jim Wright, you know, you mentioned him there, comes in for Tip O'Neill, replaces him as Speaker in the late 80s. And, you know, it's just the culture is you don't shoot the general, right? You know, you don't go after, you're a Republican, you don't go after the Speaker of the House. Newt wanted to challenge that. And he, what happened was Wright took that power Democrats had a step further than any Democrat had before him. And there's this moment in late 87. And one of the things that I try to do when I write about history, and I try to understand, like, you know, from a Republican standpoint at this point, you know, would I have done the same thing? I try to understand why they did the things they did. And I can understand when I tell you the story I'm about to, like why Republicans rallied around Gingrich, because it's late 87. Jim Wright's the Speaker of the House. He puts this tax hike bill on the floor. There's a lot of Democrats that don't want to vote for it. And it goes down. It loses by a vote. And the Republican side starts cheering. They just beat the Democrats. They're in the minority. How did that happen? And Wright leaves the vote open. And he leaves it open for 15 minutes. And he calls this guy. Yeah, this is right. And this is calls this member from Texas. You know, Jim Wright's from Texas. He's the powerhouse. This guy, he helped get elected. I'm blanking on the name, but brings him to the floor, and he changes his vote. And it goes from a one-vote defeat for the bill to a one-vote passage. He gavels it through. And that's the moment. I mean, the reaction from Michael. Michael was never more angry than after that. And that is when Gingrich, like literally days after that, holds his press conference and announces he's going to file ethics charges against Jim Wright. And it's no coincidence, because I think the Michael class of Republican leaders would have been able to rein Gingrich in without that. But at that point, like, you know what? Yeah. Let's do it. This guy deserves to squirm.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that was the impulse. And then it leads eventually, like a year and a half later, to Wright being taken down.
Well, what I love about that moment is it reminded me. And this is how I equated it. This what that moment was the equivalent of the Democrats' moment when Majority Leader Mitch McConnell shut down the Merrick Garland nomination. Same kind of it was a process thing that really pissed people off. Because we had, you know, if you're following the normal process in the case of a vote, we got more votes than you did, we win. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh no, we'll hold the vote open until I can find the number of votes I need for you to lose. Same thing on the Merrick Garland nomination. If you follow the process is you nominate, the nominee comes up to the Hill, and they meet with the members, and the Senate does its constitutional duty of advise and consent or not. But, you know, they go through the process. And when McConnell shut that down, it became a galvanizing moment for the Democrats with an eye to how they turn tables later on. And that, you know, of course, it was fed by stuff that Harry Reid had done beforehand, similar to what Wright had done back in the 80s. But I found the parallels there for me were very, very interesting in terms of how political parties abuse the process that ultimately works against them in their long-term interest.
And I think that's the thing. It's how one party abuses it, and then the question becomes, how's the other party going to react? And I think what you see, a perfect example of this, with you start with Gingrich and the story I was just telling, what that did, and this is the sort of underappreciated aspect of his rise to power, because it's in 89 that he wins a spot in leadership, which, you know, when you just a decade earlier who Gingrich was, it was unthinkable that this guy was going to end up in Republican leadership,
right.
But he does in 89. and what it was moderates, moderate Republicans who were the key votes. He had a very close leadership race, and as like Olympia Snow from Maine,
right,
voted for Newt Gingrich. Nancy Johnson from Connecticut, you know, voted for Newt Gingrich. And the reason they did was, it was the process. The behavior of Democrats like Jim Wright, and to have Newt Gingrich there, you know, basically positioning himself as policeman on Jim Wright, they said, you know what, institutionally we need Newt, because institutionally we're getting trampled and we have to fight. And I think that's the reaction. You mentioned McConnell, you know, with Merrick Garland. I can remember Democrats reacting to Tom DeLay as well during, you know, the Bush years. I think that's the common thread. Any party, when it feels that procedurally it's being trampled, that party, that minority party, then kind of runs into the arms of the radicals.
Yeah, they do. And so you had that galvanizing moment, and I want to transition from Newt, and I think this is a good way to do it. The words of Speaker Wright as he's leaving the office, he says, quote, "It is grievously hurtful to our society when vilification becomes an accepted form of political debate, when negative campaigning becomes a full-time occupation, when members of each party become self-appointed vigilantes carrying out personal vendettas against members of the other party. In God's name, that's not what this institution is supposed to be all about." That is such an exclamation point and a door-opening moment to where we are right now, because those words, I think, presage this period we're in. And you can see how a lot of the churning at that time really played itself out and became manifest by the time you get to Trump. How did those moments instituted by Newt and his radical nature? We know the Contract with America was a major milestone effort in the 94 races that really kind of turned the tide, bled into the presidential politics in subsequent races. How did these transformational moments inside the House impact electing a president and the presidential politics of the 1990s with Bill Clinton and George Bush 41, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, I think they changed Gingrich. The Gingrich style changed Congress first, and then really, you know, kind of all of American politics. And the first part of it is it was showing Republicans that, you know, you'd been in the minority in the House for decades, like we're saying, and it feels like you're just trapped there permanently. And then the story of Newt in the 80s is, well, here from a Republican standpoint is, well, here finally is somebody who's making things happen. You know, we're not sure where it's leading, but for the first time in forever, things are actually happening here. You know, Tip O'Neill's getting reprimanded, Jim Wright's getting taken down. Like,
right,
this feels like the rumblings of something here. The other part of it, too, was just a kind of an intra-Republican party thing. And that comes to a head when Bush Sr. is president. And you know, Bush Sr., famously, read my lips, no new taxes, right?
Right.
That was 1988. And his 88 convention speech, you remember the promise itself, but he preceded that promise in that speech with this pretty elaborate scenario where, you know, I'm going to be president and Congress, you know it, they're going to come to me, they're going to push me, they're going to say raise tax,
yeah,
right? He's sketching this whole thing out, and he builds to read my lips, you know, like the fifth time they ask, I'll say read my lips, no new taxes. So he becomes president, and the exact scenario he outlines happens. You know, Congress keeps coming to him, but he doesn't say read my lips. He says, yeah, sure, let's do it.
So is that Donald Trump's build the wall? Is that the hook Donald Trump finds himself on right now?
I've been wondering about that, and I don't think it is. And I say it because of this. Bush made the read my lips, to me, Bush made the read my lips promise in 88 to reassure a base, a Republican base that was very skeptical of him, the Reagan base, because he'd run against Reagan in 80. He'd been the moderate. He'd called Reaganomics voodoo economics. They didn't really believe he was one of them. He tried to remake himself as vice president. This was sort of like the trust me, really, I'm one of you kinds of things.
Okay.
So I think they were kind of looking from the minute he became president for like a sign that, yeah, he's gonna revert to being the, you know, the kind of Greenwich aristocrat that we all think he is. And that's what he kind of did with the tax tax hike. With Trump, I think that it's a little more I think he has a little bit more wiggle room because he just has so much more buy-in from the base, you know, to begin with. Go ahead.
And I was going to say, especially now that we know that he only came up with the wall thing because it was a mnemonic to help him remember to talk about immigration.
Right.
What the hell is that? Right. I'm just like, you mean to tell me we spent the last 3 years screaming build the wall and it was only because you couldn't remember to talk about immigration?
Well, and it's also like that's where I think you see a Gingrich, you know, aspect to sort of what to the Trump style and to the Trump appeal, where it's at a certain point it's not so much what you're for as it is who's against you.
Yeah.
You know, you have all the right enemies, you know, that kind of thing. And that was very much, I think, a part of what Newt's been about. And I think you see that in Trump, too. And I think the wall, you know, kind of becomes part of that as well.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, as I was asking about the sort of the transition out of what was going on in the House and how that kind of bled up into presidential politics. People forget there was a Donald Trump before there was Donald Trump, and his name was,
right.
And his name was Pat Buchanan. And
right.
And you do, I think, a phenomenal treatment of Buchanan, his emergence, and the tiger that he had become that could not be contained inside the Republican Party, and the impact he was starting to have, which again, I think, as I piece all the chapters of your book together and look at it in the context of the day, really it was kind of a seedbed in many respects for what we see. And one of the things that really struck me when you start really sort of peeling back a little bit about Buchanan, you note Buchanan had built himself as, quote, the working man's conservative, right?
Mm-hmm.
He blamed trade for real incomes that were in decline since the 1970s. While most Republicans, including Phil Graham, who was, you know, one of the leading contenders for the presidency in that race, I think this was the 92 race, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that was 96.
'96 race. They had backed NAFTA.
Yep.
They had also backed GATT, which was the General Agreements on Trade and Tariffs. And that drove Pat Buchanan nuts. And Buchanan had this great quote that you put out, quote, if you force Americans who make $10 to $15 an hour, good wages, to compete with Chinese making 25 cents an hour and hardworking Mexican folks making $1 an hour, you're going to force their wage levels down. That is so Trump. That is such a Trumpian argument in so many respects. And then he also shifted that into immigration. So you could see how even back at that time, a lot of what is now sprouted up since the 2015 campaign was really kind of well planted by a guy like Pat Buchanan.
Yeah, I mean, so many of the forces, the developments, the facts on the ground, whatever that Trump was tapping into in 2016, they were there in the 90s. I mean, the manufacturing base was in decline. You know, remember, I think one key piece of context for all kind of modern immigration debates, at least when you're trying to understand or look at the Republican side, I always think is 1986, and it's Reagan. And Reagan signs an amnesty, you know, in 86. And Reagan says, you know, as he's doing it, this is a one-time thing. You know, from now on, you know, secure borders, never going to get in this situation again, you know, and all of that. And Buchanan, you know, fast forward 5 years, and there was still a flow, a pretty heavy flow coming across the southern border in the United States. And that was the grist for Buchanan. He ran, you know, three times in the 90s. In 1992, in his first campaign, you know, he's talking about a wall. He's talking about a five-year pause, not just on illegal immigration, on legal immigration. Remember, you know, we talk so much now about, you know, identity politics. Well, in the 1990s, early 90s especially, political correctness sort of had a moment.
Right.
The show, you know, Bill Maher's got Real Time on HBO now. His first show, though, about 25 years ago, was called Politically Incorrect. Right?
Yes, I did it a number of times. I remember.
Yeah, that's right. That was a force there in the 90s, like politically
and yeah.
But it's, you know, that brand of politics was, you know, we talk about now, it was there. It was having a moment in the early 90s. Buchanan positioned himself in opposition to it. You know, you mentioned NAFTA passed in 93. I mean, Trump was still railing against NAFTA in 2016. Now he says he's renegotiated it. But yeah, all of those things were there. And that was, you know, Buchanan called it conservatism of the heart, you know, working man's conservatism, whatever. And he also, in foreign policy, he also had these very, you know, he was against, 1991 was the Gulf War, you know, which was at the time considered, you know, a great success. You know, Kuwait was liberated, ground war lasted less than 100 hours, parades all over the country. Buchanan
right.
had opposed that, you know. And again, there's you can see the connection to Trump and the foreign policy. Look at like Syria, something like that. When Buchanan attracted, I should say, this is a key part of it too, right? Buchanan, with this mix of ideology, he attracted support from the far right, and that includes David Duke. You know,
yeah.
And David Duke throughout
yes,
the 90s.
That's right.
You know, remember, David Duke made the runoff for governor of Louisiana in 91.
Yep.
And there was a moment when it's like, is this ex-Klansman going to become
as a Republican,
you know, governor of a major? Yeah, right, right. Bush Sr. was president. This is the fall of 91, and Bush Sr. denounced him and you know, couldn't have been more emphatic, you know, want nothing to do with him, and endorsed the Democrat, Edwin Edwards. Edwin Edwards, you know, was a colorful, you know, roguish
right,
politician. That
right.
was the famous bumper sticker, right? Was vote for the crook. It's important.
Right.
in that race. But Duke became a, you know, somewhat, I'd say, significant figure even after that race. And in, you know, in 96, Buchanan's down there campaigning in Louisiana. They had an early caucus. It's Buchanan versus Graham. David Duke's offering support to Pat Buchanan. And Buchanan's not emphatically denouncing it. You know, he was kind of playing footsie with David Duke. And he was talking about the parts of David Duke's message that he agreed with. He had columns written about it. So, you go 20 years later, there's Donald Trump running for president. There's David Duke coming out of the woodwork.
Yep.
The folks like David Duke coming out of the woodwork. And it was a response from Trump in that 2016 campaign that I think was very reminiscent of what you got, you know, from Buchanan when he was running in the 90s.
How scary is that? So I could spend forever on this book. I'm telling you, folks, this is such an incredibly good read. It's when I say it's an easy read, it's one of those things when you start it, you catch yourself, you realize, oh my God, I just read 50 pages. You know, you just like this goes by. It's a good read. But before we move off the book, because I want to grab a couple other things with you. I talking about Buchanan and Trump and that arc. There are two moments in the book that you step into, which I think are critically important. The first is when he started his presidential campaign, and he laid out what his goal was. He said, "I intend to redefine what it means to be a conservative in America." Now, listen to these words, folks, and think about where we are today. Right? "I intend to define what it means to be a conservative in America, to reshape our party into the natural home for the men and women who work this country." How has that played itself out? I mean, because you touched on it when, you know, you got guys like Duke back in the day running as a Republican, almost winning the nomination for governor, getting smacked down by the establishment. Pat Buchanan, you know, coming in strong the way he did in his runs for the presidency. By the time you get to 1999, this is how he's looking at it. And then the next move he makes is to leave the party. And when he does, he says, "The day of the outsider is over in the Beltway parties. The money men have seen to that. Never again will our political establishment permit a dissident to come as close to capturing a nomination as we did in 1996. Here's the kicker. They've rearranged the primary schedules and rigged the game to protect the party favorites. Folks, where have we heard this language before? Mr. Kornacki.
And yeah, and it was, and he was the rigging he was saying back then was being done for George W. Bush.
Right.
And it's so interesting to hear that again and be reminded of that, because right, it looked like in that moment, this is the end of the 90s, heading into the 2000 campaign, that the Republican Party had taken this turn away from, you know, because Buchanan had, he won New Hampshire in 96, he won Louisiana, he won a bunch of early contests, and there was this moment when it was like, and Republican leaders were panicking, when it looked like he might actually win the nomination. And then they ended up, you know, getting everybody behind Bob Dole, and they stopped him. But there, this Buchananism ran deeper in the party than Republican leaders had ever realized. That's what 96 told them. But in 2000, it looks like the party's taking a turn. And that's George W. Bush. It's the idea of, remember, compassionate conservatism.
Right.
We're going to,
right,
you know, education. And of course, you know, immigration, he had a very non, you know, Buchanan view of that. And Bush just, right, he lined up all the endorsements, all the money. He was running 50 points ahead in the polls. That's the context in which Buchanan leaves the party and says, that's it, you know, my style can never win here. It's funny, you just, okay, play out history, you know, decade and a half, you get Bush, you get two terms, you know, you get Iraq, Afghanistan, there's the things that happened historically, the collapse of the economy, the Great Recession, Obama, you know, and what emerges from that is Donald Trump taking that, pretty much that same Pat Buchanan platform in the post-Bush America, and not just winning the Republican nomination, obviously, but winning the presidency. And that coalition that we talk so much about, you know, all the time, the Trump voters in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan, I mean, that's what Buchanan envisioned. That was the Buchanan dream coalition that he was trying to create in the 90s. White working class, upper Midwest, hollowed out industrial areas. Those he believed they were the natural place for his message, that he could flip them Republican. And Trump, that is what Trump brought to fulfillment in 2016.
He was more successful at consolidating the fears of those communities than Pat Buchanan was.
Yes.
And that is, I think, the essential difference between the two men. If Pat Buchanan were able to, in his two runs for the presidency in 92 and 96, to consolidate that constituency, and to weaponize their fear about how America was changing, how it was trending, it could have been a very interesting and very different dynamic long before Trump showed up. I'd be very curious to see exactly where in space and time we would be had he been successful, even if he hadn't won the presidency so much as just really kind of locking in that attitude. I think what happened was, when, to your point about the consolidation and certainly the inability to sort of beat the establishment, to beat Bush the way he felt he could and would be able to if the system weren't rigged, a lot of his folks went back to their couches and they sat there. And mm-hmm. they started watching television, and this guy who had this funky hairstyle with a weird color, who was sitting behind a desk firing people, who seemed to be a combination of Boss Hogg and Monty, what's his name, from Let's Make a Deal.
And yeah, Monty Hall.
Monty Hall. And they liked him. And at over time, over that 10-year period, he was able, or 20-year period between 1999 and now, he was able to turn that audience into his voters, and that's what Trump did most successfully, I think.
And I think that's when I look at the Trump Buchanan parallel, that's what I keep coming back to, and I wonder because I think I know he watches it closely now. I've seen interviews with him. It must drive Buchanan nuts, the lack of because he watched Trump pull off fundamentally what he wanted to. And he's got to be sitting there thinking he's squandering it completely because, you know, Buchanan was a very disciplined person, right? You know, he would have a plan, a strategy. He would understand, you know, he could manage a presidency, I think, you know, whether you like him or not, he could certainly, you know, he could manage it just efficiently. It's got to be killing him that Trump hasn't actually been able to do anything except pretty much rhetorical stuff. But what Buchanan was missing, I think, is exactly what you're describing. There was that larger than politics quality to Trump that 30 years, you know, as a public celebrity gave him. And I think it gave him with voters, you know, a certain kind of credibility that a guy like Buchanan, a polished wordsmith, you know, a veteran of White Houses, a columnist, a pundit, you know, I think he looked, Buchanan read to a lot of people as, you know, just another kind of pundit in a box on TV. And Trump just came off as something different,
right,
larger, outside the system,
right,
something that could, you know, it could shake up the system they didn't like. But yeah, it was the buttons Trump was pushing, just ideologically, culturally, whatever, they really, it's the exact same thing Buchanan was aiming for.
And what Buchanan was missing was that P.T. Barnum quality that made the politics exciting, sexy, mysterious, crazy, wild, unexplainable, you know, unpredictable. And I called it, you know, what he did, what Trump was doing was sort of an asymmetrical political strategy that was tied to, tethered to, through the Republican National Committee and the organs of campaigning, but so far outside from it. It was an amazing thing. And the media and the other political actors on the stage with him could not figure it out. And even Bush, I don't think, could figure out Buchanan. But he had enough power and money to put his thumb on top of him and to keep him pressed down. And that's got to be frustrating to Pat Buchanan as well, because all the elements were there. It's just that he didn't have certain personal qualities that would have pulled those voters right to his bosom. And, of course, he was working up against an establishment that was not as fractionalized as it was in 2015 with 16 people standing on stage. He just really had to deal with Bush.
And he had, you know, I mean, the thing with Buchanan, too, is he did have the on paper, he had the style you're talking about. I mean,
exactly.
Whatever you think of him.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go back and you go back and watch when he wins the New Hampshire primary in 96, he comes out and he gives this speech. And he's very colorful, and he's telling, you know, he says that the fax machines in Washington are going to be buzzing, the establishment panic, they're going to do everything. And then he says, I have a message to all the Buchanan brigades out there. Don't wait for orders from headquarters. Mount up and ride to the sound of the guns. And it's just he's having fun with it, and it's a, you know, he's this great imagery, great metaphors, but right, I don't think he had the personality and the biography and sort of the status and culture that allowed him to break through outside of the kind of intensely political portion of the country,
right,
that Trump did.
Well, and here we are now, as we get ready to wind this down. I want to relate it all to the experience that federal workers are going through right now. Immigrants coming into the country are going through right now. American citizens who are concerned about not just the politics and the legislation, but the institutions that have come under attack, the cultural headbanging that has taken place with the president being the one doing the headbanging. How do you assess? Let's look at the wall. The wall discussion right now, or lack thereof, to me it's just mind-boggling. I mean, you have a situation where the president cuts the deal, sends his vice president to the Hill and says, this is the deal, president's okay, let's get this done and go home for Christmas, because he really wants to go to Mar-a-Lago and doesn't want to be here anymore, so let's get this done. Gets, you know, turns on the television and there's Laura Ingraham screaming at him. Turns on the radio and there is Rush Limbaugh telling him that it'll be the end of his presidency. And 3 weeks later, we're now sitting here with the government closed and federal workers trying to figure out how they're going to make their ends meet. How does that tactile time. Is that the sort of the Gingrich Buchanan sort of style of politics where it's you take no prisoners, there are no holds on you know, no holds are barred, etc. You just do it.
It is, although I mean, so make the Gingrich comparison to the Gingrich shutdown, you know, in 95, Gingrich and Clinton.
Right.
And, you know, Gingrich went into that and the sort of the Republican freshman class, the revolutionaries, they called themselves. You know, they thought Clinton was going to have to blink. The country would side with them. And they saw pretty quickly in the polling and the public reaction, the country was siding with Clinton. And it created, you know, it took some time, and there were a couple different shutdowns in late 95, but it was clear to them that the politics had turned against them, and that did relatively quickly, I think, force Gingrich and the Republicans to change their posture. You know, I'm looking at the polling on this, and if you actually compare the Trump versus Democrats blame game on this, the margin's about the same as what you had in 95. It's the same deficit there that Trump and the Republicans are facing. But I've only seen a couple senators, what was it, five Republicans in the House when that Democratic
right.
bill came up.
Right.
Just haven't seen the kind of breaks on the Republican side that you were
Why is that?
Definitely seeing by
Why
this
is that?
Point. You know what it is? I think it's the fact that he won. It's the fact that he won in 2016. And it's the fact that every moment you had like this where, you know, the media coverage was saying, you know, he's committing political suicide, he's destroying the Republican Party, he's going to lose now, it's all going to fall apart. And he kept winning. I mean, Republican primaries, and then, you know, obviously in the general election. And I know the midterms didn't go well for Republicans, to put it mildly.
Well,
but I do think I just think the average Republican member feels he has a bond with their voters, the Republican voters, that
but don't they realize that's
them.
A small fraction of the total vote they're going to need? I mean, you look at the senators. What, we have 20-some senators? Republican senators are going to be running in blue states in next year. And how do they survive? I mean, they cannot hook their wagon to that particular horse or star, depending on how you want to look at it, and ride it out. I just don't see how you think this ends better for you. It's like, talk about political suicide. Trump committing political suicide is like the party comes up to them and takes the weapon away from them, uses it on themselves. It's like, wait a minute, hold up. You're supposed to be stopping him, and then you're going to hurt yourself.
Yeah,
it makes no sense.
Well, I've been curious if that, you know, what, see if that happens. I mean, Cory Gardner, right? You know, Colorado,
right.
He's up next year. Clinton State. So, but he did break with.
You've got
with
eight
Trump
senators
on this.
Now. You've got eight senators now who've broken in the Senate with.
Yes, and you look at, you know, Murkowski, and I mean, you look at the
Garner.
Yep, in a Clinton State, Clinton won Maine by 3. Collins up next year. So you've got some of those who that political logic kind of works for, and you got to balance it against, you know, they're scared of primaries. How many of them are scared of primaries? How many of them are like, you know, I also kind of wonder if it factors into this is October 2013 and the Ted Cruz shutdown.
Yes.
And you remember the politics
yes.
of that pretty clearly broke against Republicans.
Yep.
And, you know, hey, a year later, I know it was an Obama midterm. It's a very different political dynamic, but still did the massive political fallout of October 2013 have any negative impact on Republicans in November 2014? No, it was there at a heck of a midterm. So I wonder if Trump has kind of accelerated a reevaluation that goes across the board of the things that politicians used to look at and say, we better not do this. We're going to pay a price in the next election. I think Trump may have accelerated a reevaluation of how much are we really going to pay a price for this a year and a half from now.
Well, on that point, then, so okay, here's my play out on the shutdown scenario and the wall. I still don't think the Democrats give him money for a wall. I think what they do is they give him money for border security in quotation marks. The language is written in such a way that the president can go out and say, see, I got money for the wall.
Yes.
But there's no wall, people. There's no wall. But the president right. will say there's a wall. And that happened sometime close to the State of the Union.
Okay. Yeah, I'd buy that. You know, I don't see a scenario where Democrats will ever, in this moment, give money for anything that they would have to admit is a wall.
Right.
Or that Trump could point to and say, look, this was built. This is clearly, obviously, exactly what I campaigned for. I think there is a lot of symbolism in this debate on both sides. Look, the money that's involved, it's been pointed out, is pretty small compared to, you know, the scope of federal spending. So what is it? And I think for the Democrats, the wall is sort of has become a symbol of what they perceive to be Trump's moral wickedness. And so to give in to a wall, to even give a cent for a wall, is in some way to sign off on what their base believes is Trump's moral, you know, awfulness. And so I can't see how Democrats, especially after the midterm they just had, which obviously has bolstered them, will give a cent for that. And from Trump's standpoint, yeah, he's got to get something here that he can act like it's a victory. I think you're right, though. You look at his history; he's able to. He has a tendency to sort of take things that are one thing and talk about them like they're another.
Like they're so something completely different.
he might have more luck at doing that. At least when it comes to his base. I think it's just a question to me of, like, he's so worried about his base here. Okay, what do they let him get away with? And I sense they like the fight. That ends up being the thing that they like more than anything. The sense that, hey, any other Republican president would have sold us out, wouldn't have gone this far. I'm guessing he'll end up getting credit from that. And then, of course, we'll pretty quickly move on to something else and everyone forget this.
That's right, because there's always another bright, shining object. And speaking of a bright, shining object, before I get you out the door, Manafort, accused of sharing Trump polling data with the Russian associates. Collusion, my friend? Can we say collusion now? Can we actually say collusion?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I saw the initial report on that. I said, oh my, you know, and then now, of course, it the reporting then changed. It was this Ukrainian, and I'm curious what I'd like to know more from this court filing. What exactly was shared?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, because again, there's part of me here that's.
I was going to say, we know that they got, I can tell you, that polling data, that's pretty deep. I mean, you don't share that kind of information with anybody. You generally
right.
don't. Because particularly at this time where we've now had the capability of layering into our micro-targeting and all the other pieces and elements that make up, you know, our database, our voting database, consumer information. I mean, really specific stuff, Steve. I mean, you know, I mean, you're at the big board. You do that. You kind of got to get your finger in the pulse. And it's not just looking at the number of registered Republicans versus Democrats in, you know, fill in X city and in X state. You have to dig, when you dig down a little bit deeper into those numbers, whether it's, you know, exit polling numbers, it's consumer data, whatever it is, it tells you a lot. So that to me was a little bit of more of a red flag than anything else we've seen when it comes to the question of, was there collusion?
Yeah, and I guess that's when I say I want to know more about what's shared. I guess that's my question. Were they sharing, you know, a comprehensive report that has everything you're talking about there, or was it a couple numbers about, hey, here's the head-to-head in you know, Wisconsin, and here's
right,
Virginia,
right.
and here, you know. I think that's partly what I want to know, because I think this was Nick Confessori who made this point, and if it's not, I apologize to him. But the difference between the initial reporting and seeing that this was Ukraine, you know, where Manafort was sharing this, and just knowing what we know about all the dealings
right.
Manafort had in Ukraine, there's a version of this, I think, and this we know more, we can find out, but there's a version of this, I think, where this is Manafort kind of trying to impress his Ukrainian, you know, benefactors with, you know, here's a little piece of inside information for you here.
Well, here's the
rub. You know, kind of like a client service thing, you know.
Steve, here's the problem with that. That Ukrainian client was tied to Russian intelligence.
Well, right.
So it's like, you know, wait a minute, dude, you didn't know your client is a Russian intel officer? Come on.
Right. Well, I mean, it gets back to the beginning of, you know, what we've known from the beginning, the question of, you know, what does it say about Trump that Manafort was in that position in the first place?
Right. All right, so taxes. Last thing. I could talk to you all day long. So taxes. Ocasio-Cortez, Alexandria, the Republican Party's favorite punching bag right now, which I think they just need to lay off the lady because, you know, it's a road you don't want to go down. Trust me, you don't want to continue this attacking the congresswoman for how she dresses and how she danced and who she danced with on the rooftop and all that crazy stuff. She's suggesting a marginal income tax rate as high as 70%. That's what you need to focus in on. And the fact of the matter is there are a lot of Democrats who are rolling their eyes at this suggestion because they know.
I want to share a little thought with you. Now, many of you are married, have kids, and
a mortgage and all that good stuff, right?
But you don't have a life insurance policy
where the economy
because you think you can't afford it. Well, let me tell you about John. John is 35 and in pretty good shape. He got a couple of life insurance quotes, and they were outrageous. Then he called SelectQuote at 1-800-394-8967. The Paris and Shop highly rated term life insurance companies for him and give you a choice for the best rate. Now, SelectQuote gave John the option of $1 million policy for under $36 a month or a $500,000 policy for under $19 a month. SelectQuote will get you better rates than by going direct to the insurers. Call them at 1-800-394-8967.
Yeah, I mean, what we were talking about earlier, there's the thing that happens and then there's the reaction from the other party to it. And that's been one of my
example policy at SelectQuote.
One of the things I've been looking for is, Trump won in 2016 and became president, and that obviously in and of itself is a very major development that's going to carry with it all sorts of implications.
Apple Podcasts,
one of the other questions right away became,
sure you stay tuned for
how is the Democratic Party going to react to this? And that's been a huge story the last 2 years, I think. It's been the formation of, you know, kind of resistance culture, what groups sort of demographically and culturally have been most invested in that, how that manifested itself in these Democratic primaries, the types of candidates that were winning. There was this new premium. You know, one of the things we saw was obviously women candidates on the Democratic side were extremely successful in 2018. There was just this clear appetite on the part of Democratic voters, female and male, to elevate, you know, female candidates in a way you hadn't seen before. And now you're seeing, okay, the fruits of that are for Democrats are now, you know, the new Congress in Washington, D.C. What the question I'm building to here is the same question I asked about Trump. Ultimately, what is the reaction of the rest of the country going to be to this new Democratic Party? Yeah. You know, because I mean, that's something we saw with, and it's, I think it's a longer term question because I don't think it's nearly sorted itself out on the Democratic side, but I think we're starting to see the direction it's going. But that's the thing you see with Newt that I have in the book, which is, you know, for 16 years, he's you know, from 79 to 95, he's known in Washington, but not really outside of Washington.
Right, exactly.
He's known in the political press. They know who Newt is.
Right.
But when that Republican Revolution hits in 94, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this guy named Newt is the Speaker of the House, and he's like the face of the Republic.
Right.
Tens of millions of people are hearing him for the first time. And the way he talked, where he would just casually, you know, accuse Democrats of Marxism and, you know, I mean, he would just use these very loaded, heavy terms and casually throw things out there. You know, this woman killed her children in South Carolina. This is 20 years ago.
Right.
And he linked it to voting Republican. I mean, it was this whole thing. The political world was numb to that, but the rest of the country had a really strong reaction to that, and it really shuffled our politics. And I say in the book, the birth of what we now call Blue America, you know, suburban, white collar professional, you know, college educated, culturally moderate to liberal, that kind of thing. The roots of that, they've been the hardcore anti-Trump we just saw in 2018. We saw that in 96. They were the ones who reacted to Gingrich in the Republican Congress the most negatively. You know, you saw it in New Jersey, Long Island, Chicago suburbs, Pacific Coast, New England. You saw it in places like that. You know, college-educated suburbs all around the country swung to Clinton, you know, by like 10, 20, 30-point swings in 1996. as a reaction to Newt. And it's a long way of saying, I'm starting to ask the same question. I think it's a longer term question. Clearly is, though, about the Democrats. I mean, you know, you had Trump's rise,
right,
and then that created for Republicans some major implications. They just got you know, cleaned out of the suburbs. That's a huge thing for Republicans.
Yeah.
And that's now a power center for Democrats. Okay, now the Democrats, that party has a measure of power. Its hold in government is more expansive, and it's a very different party right now than it was even a couple of years ago. What is the reaction to this new Democratic Party going to be? And I think that's one of the questions I'm now looking at.
Well, I can't think of anybody better to look at a question like that than you. I really appreciate your taking time and breaking down this arc of political history from the 1980s to the present day, and how you know, this thing called tribalism actually was manifest long before we were calling it tribalism. And your finger on the pulse of the body politic is an important one. Folks, if you've ever watched Steve on election night at the big board, it is a work of art. Oh, and by the way, bring your running shoes with you and a towel, because you're going to be running and sweating to keep up with him as he goes through the numbers as they come in. Folks, the Man of Steel is so happy and proud to have Steve Kornacki be a part of the conversation. He is the national political correspondent for NBC News and MSNBC. I like to call him a friend and colleague. Get the book. That's all I'm telling you. You heard us talk about the book. If you weren't juiced up after listening to that conversation about the red and blue, the blue, the 1990s and the birth of political tribalism, you don't have an ounce of life flowing through your veins, folks, because that was good stuff. Steve, thanks so much, man, for hanging with the Man of Steel. Really appreciate it.
I've done a number of these. This was the best. This was the most fun, honestly. Thank you for having me.
You got it. You got it, my man. Take care of yourself.
All right, take care.
Damn, that was a good time with Steve Kornacki. Well, got to get out of here. As you know, you can always find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts on. And you can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele. But before I go, just want to just raise one little thing with you. You know what happens to most of us at some point or another? Debt just sort of creeps up on you. You know how that is? How many of us have looked at our finances and screamed, "How can we make this much and still have so much debt?" Unexpected repairs, replacing the washer and dryer, medical bills, and of course the killer, those insane interest credit cards you had to use to pay for it all, right? Here's a really smart move that could help you get on top of your finance. Get a fixed rate personal loan at bestegg.com. The rates are great right now. Now imagine finally being able to pay down those crazy high credit cards and bills, and then bank the money you save each month. Consumers have rated Best Egg 4.8 out of 5 stars on Consumer Affairs because of the super easy online app that takes about a minute with no impact to your credit score. Upon approval, funds can be deposited in as little as one business day. So get your bills under control. Bank what you save and take control of your finances with a loan from bestegg.com. Visit bestegg.com/plan. That's bestegg.com/plan.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.